Good day, everyone. This is March Twisdale, and I'd like to welcome you to Prose, Poetry, and Purpose. You're listening to my show on Voice of Vashon, webcast in real time at voiceofvashon.org, also available on archive and broadcast on Comcast Channel 21. For first-time listeners, Prose, Poetry, and Purpose is a monthly show revolving around local and international guest authors who share with us how they see their fiction, memoir, or poetry playing an effective role in society through their readers. Thank you all for tuning in today as I chat with Julian Hoffman, an award-winning writer who is currently calling in from the cool upper reaches of Greece. Good morning, Julian, or should I say good evening?
Good morning, March. It's evening here, morning for you, but it's a lovely late evening now. The last of the sun is falling over the mountains here in Greece, and I think there's about a 10-hour time difference between us, so it's a pleasure to get to organize this and appear on the show. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure, and I must say I do find modern technology sometimes to be quite delightful, as it was transportation technology that allowed us to meet in Seattle during the AWP conference, and now it's telecommunication and I believe space technology that is allowing us to conduct this interview from literally opposing sides of the planet. It's pretty amazing, I think.
It is, and it was a real joy to meet you at AWP in Seattle, and it was my first time out onto the west coast of North America, and I had a fabulous time, a lot of wonderful encounters with different people and places, and meeting you was one of the highlights, so it's great to be able to connect now that I'm back home on this side of the world, and you're still over there.
Well, I can tell you one day I definitely want to visit.
You're always welcome, just let me know.
That'd be awesome. Bring some kids, and then, yeah, we may not be so welcome.
Exactly.
Okay, so let's dive right in. While we will eventually get to your recently released collection of creative nonfiction, I was hoping that you might first give our listeners a sense of where you do currently live and write, because you are not, as they say, living in the average suburb, are you?
No. I'm happy to let you know where I'm living right now. And my wife and I, we both live here in a place called the Prespa Lakes. And the Prespa Lakes are two lakes, Great and Lesser Prespa, that are shared by three countries. They're shared by Greece, Albania, and the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia. And we live in the Greek part, which is this wonderful high mountainous region lying above the lakes with deep, deep beach forests and ancient juniper woods. And it's a really, really different place from, let's say, Greece of the imagination. But I should probably backtrack for just a second and perhaps explain how we came to be here, because that's certainly been features a great deal in my writing. And it's also very, very much a story that ultimately changed our lives quite radically, because we were both living in London many, many, many years ago. And we'd reached a stage in our lives where we knew essentially it was time to set out for home in a way. We were looking to change our lives, and we'd grown tired of the big city. We'd grown tired of commuting across it for our jobs, and we were discovering that more and more often, whatever free time we had on the weekends, let's say, we were spending getting out of the city to go walking along the coast or in forests and spend some time camping. And we knew that we wanted to move somewhere, but the question, of course, was where would we go?
Mm-hmm.
And we kept putting these different names into a kind of imaginary hat that we had. Now, I grew up in Canada, so it was an obvious choice as one possibility. So we took Canada on this little slip of paper and put it into this imaginary hat. And then after a particularly boozy night, we wrote Madagascar on a slip of paper and put that into this imaginary hat. And we woke up a little bit hungover and took it back out, not knowing how we would ever move there or what we would do. And we realized that perhaps it was best to stay in Europe for a whole host of reasons, that it was easy for us to move and get work. But we still didn't know where to go. And at the time, we happened to be members of an organization called the Royal Society for Protection of Birds that worked on behalf of birds and bird habitats within the United Kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
And as members, we used to receive a quarterly magazine that, you know, had various reports from their nature reserves and about different species of birds. And at the back of this particular issue, there was a handful of book reviews. And one of these books that was reviewed was written by a Greek biologist called Yorgos Katsidorakis. And he'd written a book called Prespa, A Story of Man and Nature. Now, neither of us had ever heard of this place called Prespa.
Mm-hmm.
But we read the review, and it was a glowing review that talked about this place where two lakes straddle three countries, and rare pelican colonies, and brown bears in the woods, and ancient Byzantine monuments amidst the stone villages. And we thought, wow, that sounds a really interesting place to go visit for a week. Do some walking, do a bit of bird watching, get out into the tavernas and maybe meet a few local people. So we decided to order this book. And a week or so later, the book arrived in the post, and we both came home from work that day and opened it up as we started preparing some dinner. And I think we opened a bottle of wine, and we started leafing through some of the pages that part of Yorgos Katsidorakis' book. He was also an excellent photographer, so there was a number of images that began slowly to reveal this place called the Prespa Lakes region. And I think we probably opened another bottle of wine, kept reading various passages out to one another, looking at more photographs. And by the time we'd finished the evening and I was getting ready to go to bed, we decided that rather than simply visit this place called Prespa, we would just move there.
Wow.
So we packed up all our belongings and moved to this village called Agios Iamenos, which is sits above the Prespa Lakes. And 14 years later, we're still here. So we've managed to settle in and make a home for ourselves. So we were brought here by a book. And what I quite like about that story is that it kind of reveals, for me at least, you know, the sheer power that words and writing and books ultimately can have on our lives. So This is where we are, and we're still here and happily here.
And how many people live in your village?
In the village itself, there's about 150 people, so a pretty drastic difference from living in inner city London, as we did
exactly
14 years ago before we left. So yeah, there's about 150 people here. So
in a way, you are living the dream that so many of my listeners probably want to live, that just inspiration hits at the right moment and you go for it.
Yeah, and I think, you know, what you've just said, that inspiration of any description can hit in a moment. And, you know, sometimes it's, well, often it's great when we can embrace it and take hold of it and just see where it leads us. And, you know, obviously we were quite a bit younger then than we are now. But we felt, well, we want to change our lives. We want to do something quite a bit different. We wanted to grow a lot of our own food. We wanted to be able to step out the door and either walk, let's say, in some meadows and mountains or beside some lakes. So this place,
yeah, compared to walking,
we made it fit in very, very clearly was what we really wanted to do with our lives, to radically change how we were going about living our lives.
Right. And in a way, you sort of already had your dream. You already had the idea. You'd been, don't take this wrong, but you'd been chugging the wine and throwing the little pieces of paper into the imaginary hat. And so your brain was already sort of like, you know, in creation mode. And then,
very much so.
Yeah,
very
like you were very fertile soil for the seed that book was.
Yes, exactly. We were ready for change. And, you know, I often think that when we are ready for change and when we're open to change, or when we're open to all the multitudinous things that arise about us at any given moment, there's all these extraordinary and astonishing things that can happen, even on a day-to-day basis in the lives that we live, you know, when we're open to the things that are around us. So we were very, very fortunate, and we were welcomed wholeheartedly with an astonishing level of hospitality when we turned up in this village that with just two very, very, very large backpacks that we carried those belongings that we thought were essential in starting out this new life of ours.
Mm-hmm. So in addition to that, though, I think you'd already been playing around with the idea of writing yourself, correct? That was already like on the horizon a bit?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I've been writing for many, many years, but not in a committed way. So the move, this move for me personally was very much, I mean, it was born of writing in two senses. The first sense is this wonderful book that Yorgos Katsidorakis had written that mm-hmm. brought us here. And the second of those two things were the fact that I finally wanted to try and find some way of committing to my writing, you know, which I'd been doing in a very haphazard way
for a long time.
And
yet, if I remember correctly from our earlier conversation, irony of ironies, after following your, you know, what do they call that? Follow your Zen or whatever. After following your dreams to this beautiful place with this idea of I'm going to take my writing seriously, you ended up actually not writing for, I think, about 5 years because you fell into some other activities. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that? Because people on Vashon in particular, as well as mm-hmm. our many listeners in other places, are going to probably relate to this piece as well.
Okay, yeah. You know, we arrived and we didn't know what we would do here. I'd set my heart on finally committing to writing. And my wife, Julie, really wanted to get involved in environmental work. And interestingly, for about 5 years, neither of those things happened because we actually became more organic farmers, essentially organic market gardeners. We decided to rent some very, very large fields and decided to, it began originally as an organic herb business, but it then branched out after the first year so that we were raising all different kinds of vegetables, salads, herbs, a few fruits that we were selling on a weekly basis to restaurants in Greece's second city, which is called Thessaloniki, the second city to Athens. And so for five years, we worked the land here. We rented these wonderful set of fields right at the edge of the village, between the village and the mountains. So they were set at the foot of the mountain slopes, and they were an extraordinary, enriching time in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't really do a great deal of writing for 5 years. I'm sure some of your listeners will know. You know, working the land is a pretty full time commitment.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly if you're doing that organically and doing a lot of the work manually, as we were, and trying to bring back, various heritage seeds that were being lost increasingly Europe-wide. That was one of my little pet passions
mm-hmm.
that I had, trying to bring back into cultivation.
Oh, yeah. I can completely relate on our, we have a small farm here on Vashon, and
mm-hmm.
I make
mm-hmm.
sure that whenever we buy seeds, it's like, about 100 years ago, at the end of the 1800s, there were around 6,000, might be 600, but I'm pretty sure it's 6,000 varieties mm-hmm. of potatoes that were being cultivated throughout the country. And now there's like 9.
Very few, I imagine.
Yeah, there's nine out there. I actually, after about 3 months of searching, found a really great source of unique. They have like, maybe 55 different unique potato varieties, and I was jumping up and down in my house squealing.
So I'm
really excited to hear that you guys also were looking for the unique, soon to be lost varieties.
Yeah, because I personally think there's a number of things at play there, and one of them is the extraordinary traditional heritage that is being increasingly lost. You know, those specific seed varieties are often extremely localized.
Mm-hmm.
They've been raised often by families within a particular locality. They're geared towards certain weather conditions and patterns and frost dates and
mm-hmm.
all of that. That kind of wonderful local resilience and knowledge is just almost immediately lost because
mm-hmm.
that tiny seed is a storehouse of an extraordinary level of knowledge and practice and craft.
Mm-hmm.
Often that's been in practice for centuries. And, you know, we live in an age now where so many of those varieties are being put out and lost. And along with it is that traditional knowledge and ways of life and the durability of seeds and varieties to particular local conditions. And it's a crime, really, that we're losing all of that.
Right. But it's also an exhausting job being a farmer. So how did it go around the end of year five?
We stopped a little prematurely, and you're right, it is. It's, in my case, backbreaking, and I mean that literally. It's, you know, we worked the fields. There were long hours, as I'm sure a lot of your listeners will know. And my body simply gave out.
Mm-hmm.
My wife, Julius, didn't. She's far stronger than I am. And around about the fifth year, I think it was, all of a sudden, I just had these absolutely excruciating pains. Mm-hmm. Right down my legs, and of course it was from slip discs in my back, and the pain was so bad that I couldn't sleep, and I couldn't walk, and I couldn't stand, and I couldn't lie down. And you know, at midnight I was in the garden trying to walk the pain off, and it just didn't work. So I was eventually hospitalized, and you know, had a series of injections. And
ow.
On that first night when I was, yeah, that wasn't a great experience.
Mm-mm.
If truth be told, but on that very first night, because the hospital is about 50 kilometers over the mountain pass from us, and Julia took me down, and you know, I was admitted to the hospital, and just before she was about to drive back home over the mountains, and it was evening, and I asked her if she would go downstairs to the little shop in the hospital, and just see if she could find a cheap pen and a little cheap notebook. And if she could bring them up for me before she left. And that evening, in that hospital bed beneath those bright fluorescent hospital lights that we probably all have experienced at some stage in our lives,
mm-hmm.
I began sketching out and writing the first part of a short story set here in Prespa, a short story which is called Pelicans.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that evening that my body was telling me something, but it was important for me to listen to these excruciating pains in my legs, the slip discs in my back, which were the result of five wonderfully enriching years. Unfortunately, it was also time to let the fields go. And my body was saying it was time to get back to that thing that I'd ultimately really dreamed about and been
mm-hmm.
in love with for much of my life, and that was the written word. And it was time to give up the heavy digging and put pen to paper.
Right.
So that beginning to write that story that evening in hospital was in many ways me finding a way back home to the place where writing begins.
Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, that's a story a lot of people can relate to, because so often we have this thing that we want to do, and then there's just this, life gets in the way, even if it's a beautiful life that we're enjoying. And then, you know, it's like, if we don't figure that out on our own, I think the universe is
mm-hmm.
like, yo, bam, buddy, you need to go back that direction now. And you're like, okay, I'm listening now, right?
Yeah, yeah. And I think sometimes it's important to accept that there are some things we simply can't do anymore as our bodies change, as, you know, we have to embrace the aging process as much as possible, and sometimes those things that we love, you have to put them aside for the sake of other things that are important to you. At least that was my experience of it.
Mm-hmm. So, as you mentioned, this was your first published short story, Pelicans?
I think it was about my second, actually.
Okay.
If I remember correctly.
Ryan, it was pretty much literally written that night. Obviously, you had been picking up all sorts of experiences throughout the previous 5 years that
mm-hmm,
fed this
mm-hmm.
Story. I know it's too long for you to be able to read the whole thing, but you know, I almost cried when you did read it. I was wondering if there was either if you wanted to give our listeners a little teaser. It can be found right now, can't it, if I remember correctly, if people search just your name, or would they go to terrain.org? Is that where it currently is located?
Yeah, it can be found online at terrain.org, and it's also just been reprinted in a wonderful anthology called Among Animals.
Oh, that's the one that Midge. That's the one Midge has.
Yes, The Lives of Animals and Humans in Contemporary Short Fiction, and that's been published by the wonderful new, relatively new press called Ashland Creek Press.
Right. So that
I met Midge Raymond and John Younker, the publishers of the people behind Ashland Creek Press in Seattle, and that's how I met you, of course. And it's a lovely, lovely collection of short stories. So it was a real honor to have the story appear there.
Yeah,
and
no
thank
kidding.
Thank you for the kind words. I'm delighted that you enjoyed the story.
Yeah, yeah. So Midge Raymond, for my regular listeners, was, I believe, my February show. They will probably remember. So this is Among Animals. So anyone who wants to go to www.ashlandcreekpress.com, just Google it. I can't remember if it's .com or .org, but Ashland Creek Press.
Yeah, I can't remember, I'm afraid.
AshlandCreekPress.com,
it is.
.com, okay. And then Among Animals is the collection that your piece is in. I think they can also find it if you look up Terrain, which we'll talk about more later, terraine.org, and then put in your name, Julian Hoffman. It pops right up there, and it's a fabulous read, although the book's even better because it's got so many other stories in there. Do you want to tell our listeners just a little bit of the backstory on that piece? Because it's, like, I thought it was a real story, and, you know, it's really powerful.
Thank you. Thank you. No, it's, I mean, the lakes where it's set and the pelican colonies, which I'll describe briefly in a second, are real. But the story is an invented one, but using those kind of real focus of this particular place. So the story's called, for your listeners here, the story's called Pelican, the short story. And it's set here in Greek Prespa, the Greek side of the Prespa Lakes. And I hadn't been living here that long when I first started writing, about 5 years. And I think I wasn't yet comfortable with approaching this place through nonfiction. So I decided to approach it originally through fiction and to tell a story of a fisherman who meets a biologist on the shore of the lake. And the story is kind of told through through flashback. The fisherman is a relatively old man now, and he's returned to the lake long after he stopped fishing. And he meets quite a young biologist who's here beside the lake studying the pelican colonies. And one of the things that's really important about the Prespa Lakes is it's home to two species of pelicans, the white pelican, which I think you get in the United States along the West Coast, and possibly the East, I'm not sure.
We do have white, and we also have brown.
Right, okay. So here we have the white pelican, but we also have a much more localized and rarer species called the Dalmatian pelican. And it's an endangered bird, and the Prespa Lakes hold about between 10 and 12% of the bird's entire global population. We have about 1,400 pairs that nest here each summer.
Wow.
And it's wonderful to watch them circling down over the mountains and to land on the lake, and they raise their young here.
Well, hold on. Let me interject. Wait, let me interject just with a question then there. Because one of the things that comes up for me a lot of times with birds that I think many people are not yet really aware of or haven't fully embraced is the roaming pattern. You know, the fact that they will go to so many different places in the world, and if one of those places ends up having major environmental damage done, you know, they lose their fields or they lose a feeding zone, they can literally leave and just never make it back. And it doesn't matter if where you live is pristine, they can get caught up somewhere else. So these pelicans that are in your area, do you also know where they go on their annual migration? And do you have a sense of whether their population, like, drops sometimes? I mean, around here, I'm sure there used to be 10, there, we have like 98% loss of most of the birds, and people look out there and go, oh, they're so pretty. And I always think, yeah, and there should be, you know, 100 times as many of them. But people get so used to it. Like, you just get acclimated to what's going on. You just think it's normal for there to be 9 birds out there instead of 900. So what's going on with that?
Well, I think, for a start, I think that, you know, in recent decades, there has been a shift slow, but a definite shift in recognizing that birds don't exist, at least the migratory species, don't exist solely in one place. Mm-hmm. Because it was always common, you know, I spent many years living in the UK to hear people talking about our birds. But of course, those birds would often only spend a few months of the full calendar year in the UK because they would breed there. But as soon as the young had fledged and the parents were ready to move off, it was often only August, and the birds wouldn't return until April or May of the following year. So the birds are actually at home in a number of different places, both on their flyways, on their migratory flyways and routes, and also in their winter grounds, which in our case here in Europe is often in Africa. And for you in North America, of course, a lot of those species, I presume, will be migrating down into Mexico or South America. Not all species, of course. So the two pelicans that we have here, they actually both do quite different things. The white pelican, which is considerably more common, internationally speaking, it travels all the way to Africa, generally always south of the Sudan. So it goes on a long, long, and often pretty perilous journey. And these birds, because they require thermals for their flights, they rarely fly over large bodies of water like the Mediterranean Sea. So they will tend to follow a route that takes them down over Istanbul and the Bosphorus Strait, and then down across the Middle East, usually over Israel, and then across Egypt and down into Africa.
That's perilous for every species of animal.
Yes,
those regions.
Absolutely.
Yikes.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And the Dalmatian pelican, though, it doesn't go nearly as far because it's located much more centrally in southeastern Europe. So some birds, they all leave, well, most of them, nearly all of them leave the Prespa Lakes because of our altitude. It gets extremely cold here in winter, and the small lake sometimes completely freezes over. So as I said, it's not quite Greece of the imagination. We get a lot of snow and ice here.
Right.
And a few years ago, I think our water pipes, they froze, I think it was 46 days.
Not
counting, but 46 days and some hours and a few minutes. So the Dalmatian pelican, some of them remain in other parts of eastern and southern Greece, but a lot of them go to Turkey, also to the Middle East. So they don't go nearly as far. And because they don't go nearly as far, they often return really early. And it's a really strange experience to watch these pelicans returning to the Prespa Lakes to breed, and they're flying through blizzards. They're returning for the summer season, but they come back in January often.
Mm-hmm.
The earliest ones return in January, and then they a lot more of them then tend to start flying in February. But they'll occasionally land, and the lake will be frozen, and there'll be snow everywhere, and we'll watch them sailing through blizzards and storms. So it's quite a strange experience watching pelicans, watching the Dalmatian pelican particularly return.
What do
the
they
white
eat?
Pelican comes back quite a bit later because it has a much longer journey to make.
But what do they eat when everything's frozen over like that?
It's a very, very good question. they have to then fly off, as they do throughout the breeding period. In fact, the both species of pelicans will make daily trips to other lakes nearby which aren't frozen. And the large lake here, it never freezes. Certainly never frozen in any historical terms that I know of. I think I once met a very, very elderly man who said when he was a boy, he thought he remembered it freezing. So it might have last frozen in the 1920s. So there's always the large lake, but the pelicans will often fly off to other nearby lakes, even halfway across Greece, because using these thermals and their extraordinary wingspan, they can cover vast distances in a very, very short period of time. So even now, and on any given day, you will watch these big cauldrons of pelicans circling up and then disappearing high over the mountains, because we live in a bowl of mountains. So for them to get anywhere, they leave over the mountains. And it's an astonishing experience watching these water birds
Right.
fly high over the these lovely alpine meadows in order to arrive at other lakes in the region.
Right. Here on the West Coast, they pretty much live over the ocean, like, at all times.
Yes.
I mean, you know,
yes.
But there are, when I lived in Reno, Nevada, which is very inland, it's on the inland side of the Sierra Mountains, right? Big time inland.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
There's a lake actually called Pelican Lake, and there's a bunch
okay.
of white pelicans that live there,
mm-hmm.
and I think they actually stay there year-round. Like, there's this belief that one time some of them made it over and said, we're not going to try to go back again, we're just going to stay here now. But okay, so I took us off in that direction a little bit because I really was curious
But
back to your story.
I can't remember how far up I got from telling the backstory, but essentially this old fisherman who returns to Prespa, he's been living abroad for a while, he returns to Prespa and he meets a young biologist who's here studying the pelicans. And the two men begin talking, and the fisherman recounts a story. So the story is actually told, a story within a story. The fisherman recounts a day when he and his wife, called Eleni, were fishing on Great Prespa Lake when one of these wild, sudden, violent summer storms that we get, in fact, we had one only 2 nights ago,
mm-hmm.
suddenly sweeps across the lake while they're out fishing on it. And he tells the story of what happened.
Mm-hmm. Don't give it away.
No, that's all I was going to say.
Okay. Wow. And it's quite a story, and the birds play a pivotal role.
They do. They play a very, very pivotal role in the piece itself.
And I think the previous view that the fisherman has towards the birds and the view he has towards them afterwards, there's a shift there.
There is. There's a fundamental shift in how the fisherman once saw the pelicans to how he sees them after this experience he has on the lake.
Right.
I won't read that part of it because it gives a little bit too much away of the story, but there is. Some decades ago, the pelicans were actually essentially considered a pest in much of Greece, and there was a bounty on their heads.
Mm-hmm.
So and all fishermen the,
yeah.
hunted them because they were believed to eat a lot of the fish species. And obviously, attitudes have shifted, and they've shifted dramatically.
Good.
Since that time.
Good. Good.
And
yes, and that's and the whole point of my show is, you know, giving people a chance to talk about how through stories, which happen to be written down and then
mm-hmm.
are shared via the radio, Go Technology, how, you know, stories and the way we live in the world change and shift. And one person's story that changes their life, if it's then written down and, you know, offered out to the world through the written word, can, you know, perhaps create shift in hundreds or thousands or millions of people's viewpoints. So the power of the pen once again. And real quickly, though, I'm going to go ahead and give a quick reminder to our listeners. Thank you for tuning in. You're listening to Prose, Poetry, and Purpose on Voice of Vashon at voiceofvashon.org. My name is March Twisdale, and I'm talking today with Julian Hoffman, a wonderful writer who I believe you recently won an award at AWP. You can mention that in a minute because that was very cool. Also, he spent time being a market gardener after leaving his life in the United Kingdom to move with his wife to a very small mountain village in northern Greece where they started an organic small holding. And I guess this came largely from the inspiration of a book, which you can go check out my show as an archive or listen to the beginning of it if you missed it and hear that story. Also, Julian, you're a photographer, correct?
Yes, I'm a photographer as well as a writer. And, you know, for many years, I used to really enjoy taking photographs. And then I kind of fell out of love with it until I think the digital cameras came out. And I decided to get a very, very cheap, easy-to-use camera to use primarily as a visual notebook. That's what I decided to, because a lot of my writing emerges out of landscapes and visual, and I thought, this is a good idea. I can use this and record just certain moments and landscapes and refer back to them in my writing.
That's such a great idea. Oh my God, that's amazing.
Yes, well, and of course what happened is that certain things come back to us, like old songs and memories, you know, and what came back for me was my deep love of taking images. And, you know, there's a wonderful American writer who tragically died quite young called Ellen Malloy. And in one of her essays, she says just a very, very simple sentence, which is that perception itself is the embrace. And I think this is really, really key. And what I love doing with my photography now, because I see it as kind of married to the words, mm-hmm. though I don't always publish them together, but I love the ability with the camera to look extraordinarily closely at something, at any given thing, whatever that might be, mm-hmm. because I think it's the act of looking, the act of attention mm-hmm. that's really, really important. And the camera's a wonderful tool to do that. And there's a British writer called Mark Cocker, who one of my favorite quotes comes from him, and he says that a really significant element in ascribing beauty to a thing lies not within itself, but in the quality of our attention to it.
Right.
I think that's absolutely perfect, because it really is about a mindfulness. And I think taking photos is a way of being mindful, potentially. So I like to kind of bring the visual to the written, to my writing as well these days, whenever I can and as much as possible. And there's often echoes that you can find between places. And on my book tour on the West Coast some months ago, I arrived at the Point Reyes National Seashore, mm-hmm. Northern California, which is a spectacular place. But one of the reasons I was really excited about photographing it is because there were echoes of the Prespa Lakes that I found there. Quality of light, the shape of the hills. There's all kinds of differences, but there are often these shadows or echoes you find in between places. Now, I love these correspondences and connections that we can sometimes locate in the world, and how it can also ground us as we go about our lives, often in movement as well. And that's a theme I pick up later in my book, of course.
Right. You know, that's so interesting you bring up the point, I mean, about attention, because it just hit me as you were talking about that people who go on vacation mm-hmm. are paying really close attention. They're like mm-hmm. snapping pictures, and they're looking in the water, and they're listening to the birds, and they're really attentive to their environment because they're on vacation and they paid $4,000 for this week.
Yeah,
and they're, gosh darn it, going to get their value out of it. And then they go home, and for a lot of people, the attention just slips. And one of the things my husband always says, I mean, like, 8 times a week, he'll just turn to me and I'll be like, oh, it's so beautiful. You know, I really love where we live. I'll say, oh, it's so beautiful. And he'll turn to me and say, and you know what? There's no place on earth that's more beautiful or less beautiful. We live somewhere that people would go to vacation, and mm-hmm. we don't have to go on vacation to be able to be somewhere beautiful. But he doesn't mean that just because, like, we live in some special place. He means it because he's always seeing everything around him, no matter where he is.
Yeah.
Now, here's a question, though, that comes up for me because, you know, some of our listeners might be thinking, okay, March, you live on Vashon Island. It's, you know, it's known to be sort of visually idyllic. And Julianne, you live in this beautiful place with only 150 people. And sure, mm-hmm. it's really easy to see beauty because you guys live in beautiful places. But my memory from some of your writing is, I mean, you lived in London and you saw beauty in lots of other places. What is it, what did you see when you were in a more industrialized type of an area that also, you know, I don't know, how do I say this? I'll probably edit all that out. Ha ha. Okay. So,
it was good. It was very good. You know, I know what you mean. I think that, you know, we have a cultural approach to a number of different landscapes and what we consider to be aesthetically appealing and beautiful, and to those other landscapes, which are sometimes called the edge lands and industrial sites that often aren't. But even if it's an industrial site, you know, there's often these astonishing moments, potentially, of great beauty. And on the outskirts of London, there's a wonderful range of often quite rare birds that can be found, for example, in some of these sites. And, you know, the wonderful English nature writer Richard Mabey wrote an entire book called The Unofficial Countryside. And he wrote this a few decades ago, and it was extremely radical at the time, because he went about to these dilapidated peripheries of urban areas which didn't exist in the mental space of almost anybody. And he found this extraordinary wilderness of wildflowers, sometimes rare, sometimes common, fabulous insects and different bird species. And he set about sort of charting and taking account of this other landscape that is often very wild, because I think what happens is that these places, and the writer Mike Cocker talks about this, that these industrial sites or the edgelands of our urban areas, they're unmanaged and uncared for, and precisely because of that, they're often extraordinarily wild.
Mm-hmm.
And the wild always comes in, and it comes in this extraordinary profusion. So, I mean, I did live in London, and I ultimately had to make a decision to leave it. But when I started writing my book, The Small Heart of Things, what I wanted to start doing was to establish whether it was possible or find a way of, or ask the question perhaps, is it possible to be at home in the world? And, you know, I spend a lot of time bird watching, and something that I noticed when we moved to the Prespa Lakes, which is this quite wild, very beautiful place, but there were certain common bird species, like European starlings, robins, blackbirds, wrens, that I was now finding in deep wild forests and huge expansive meadows.
Mm-hmm.
But that wasn't the first time I'd encountered these birds,
mm-hmm.
because I'd first discovered them or learned about them in inner city London.
Right.
And these particular bird species, they're able to adapt to urban areas because they find food in city parks, in people's back gardens. And what I began to realize is that these birds had a way of straddling the aesthetically, you know, what we might describe as either the difference between a beautiful landscape and perhaps a not so beautiful landscape.
Mm-hmm.
And they were at home in the world, these birds.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to work out through my book whether it was possible to try and go about being at home in the world ourselves in some way by making connections, deepening our awareness of wherever we happen to be. And some of my most extraordinary moments or encounters with wild creatures have come in urban areas.
Right.
And you know, I did some wonderful bird watching in Seattle. And it was fabulous. You know, it really was fabulous. And then I went up to Victoria, which isn't a big city, but, you know, I was watching hummingbirds flashing this wonderful scarlet and iridescent green through the rain. And then when I was in San Francisco, I was watching, you know, feral parakeets and ravens tumbling out of the Presidio. And, you know, all the while, there's millions of people going about their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And things. So even in urban areas, when we pay attention, I believe there are moments of extraordinary beauty. And the writer, the great American writer, Barry Lopez, tells a lovely short story called Winter Herons. And for me, it really encapsulates something beautiful about the potential of urban areas. And the character in this short story called Winter Herons, he watches this flock of herons descend through a great blizzard, this huge snowstorm in New York City, and land in the middle of the city. And there's only this one man who's aware of this flock of herons that lands.
Mm-hmm.
There's a taxi driver that turns a corner and he's unaware. There's somebody who goes into the door of their apartment. They're not aware.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, this character really represents how awareness can lift us out of ourselves and deepen our connection, strengthen our connection
right.
with the world around us, wherever that might happen to be.
Right.
And I think to be at home in the world doesn't mean that you want to necessarily live in those places that you're traveling through, but to deepen our awareness and to enrich our connections, hopefully. Potentially.
Or to be at home in the world, I mean, does not mean that, okay, you know, twice a year I get to go on a trip somewhere and go look at beauty, and then I come back and spend the rest of my life, you know, not noticing what's around me. So, every single day can truly be richer.
Yeah, because I think what can also happen, even when you live in a beautiful place, it's very, very easy for that beauty to become habitual to the point where you no longer notice it.
Right.
So it's really important to be aware wherever you are, whether it's your beautiful landscape you happen to live within,
mm-hmm.
because it's easy for things to lapse into repetition.
Well, it's a conscious choice.
To become unaware of it all.
Right, but it's a conscious choice. I mean, it's like literally you have to decide, I want to be a person who remains aware. Because as children, we start off really fundamentally aware. And there's, you know, I mean, people make the choice. They'll like look up and go, yeah, whatever, that's there every day. Like they'll say, who cares about Mount Rainier? I see it every day. Well, they made the choice to value newness of something and value going somewhere to see something new and to believe that if you've seen it a lot, therefore it's become boring. That's actually a choice. And for me, like every time I see Mount Rainier, I'm just like, oh, it's so pretty. You know, it's like every time. So,
and I think you're completely right to mention children there, because I think children are actually the true guides to perception. And they practice without knowing it, of course, but they practice something that I describe or call an equality of interest, because it doesn't have to be a huge mountain that engages their imagination and their curiosity, because, you know, they can find just a tiny little patch of scrubby meadow with a few butterflies, and I still see this despite sort of all the kind of technological changes that we're witnessing and, you know, children having phones and various things and games while they're out and about. But I still, and it pleases me no end, I still see children engaging with this tiny patch of scrubby ground.
Mm-hmm.
And for them, it's not a tiny patch of scrubby ground, because for them, it's an entire world. And it's a world full of possibilities. And I think that they're the guides, because there's possibility in the smallest of things. And I think that's our way in by, in many ways, by returning, in a perceptual sense, to the children we were. And engaging with the world by remaining open to anything, and the small heart of things. My book has it travels to various parts of the world. It's not set solely in Greece, but there's really only one guide alongside children, one other guide to the essays within it, and that's the poet Rilke, because he wrote a lovely poem called "Remember Me," and two lines from it act as the kind of heart of the book, as it were, and he says, everything beckons us to perceive it, murmurs at every turn. And I think what's absolutely wonderful about Rilke's phrase there is that he's offering us an invitation, he's giving it an opening, he's saying, let in the wild and the unpredictable, all of those things that actively engage our imagination, but also let in the ordinary and the often unsung and the overlooked. Let it all in, because everything beckons us to perceive it. And that's precisely what children are already practicing without their knowing.
Right.
So that's
until we train them.
My book around that, that idea of murmurs at every turn.
And yeah, exactly. And I think a lot in we are living in a society that fights against what it is that you're actually reminding us of. Because, you know, a lot of the economic systems are absolutely dependent upon turning us into a bunch of rats that are in a race for something that they want to offer us and giving us tunnel vision. So, I mean, over and over, I'll be like, wow, you know, there's so many situations where people are missing the free, available, fabulous things around them because they believe unless you've spent money on something, it can't be valuable. So your work, and it's not just about, oh, learn to see the beauty around us. I mean, that's huge and important, but that is a deep, deep underlying foundation to other necessary changes, because we have lived in a consumer mentality long enough to get to the point where we're running out of available resources for consumption. And so
absolutely.
It's not, you know, if we want, we have a choice in front of us. Once again, we can choose to believe that the way we will start to live will be worse than the way mm-hmm. we live, mm-hmm. or we will choose to recognize how much we've been missing and realize that a new way of living that's more sustainable can actually be more nourishing and be a better way of life. So your work really attracted me because I'm always thinking sometimes, you know, about the great change that is approaching us that we are in the middle of, and your work just really, but now you have to read because we're going to run out of time, and I know you have a piece that you brought to read and I'm looking forward to hearing it.
Okay. Okay. So what I'll do is I'll read just a very, very short opening to an essay which is called An Accumulation of Light. And I think we've probably all experienced something similar, that certain days they outlive others. They're lit differently in memory. And this was such a day. It's set on a wonderful steppe habitat called Cape Kaliakra on the coast of Bulgaria. And this is really, the essay itself is really about those glints and glimmers, or what might materialize from those glints and glimmers that we sometimes see from the corner of our eyes, or as Rilke might say, those murmurs at every turn.
Mm-hmm.
An accumulation of light. It reached me as an afterglow. We were walking on a cliff-edged path when a faint light glimmered at the corner of my eye. I stopped and looked down on the sea for a while, reluctantly accepting that it must have been the sparkling roll of a wave that I'd seen, a crest of bright water. I'd taken a few more steps along the path when I saw it again, fleetingly, like a vague memory dredged from the depths. Watching the water more closely this time, I looked for disruptions in its undulating rhythms, but nothing other than sunlight played on the vast surface of the Black Sea. From 70 meters up, at the top of red sandstone cliffs, the sea was spread out in a shimmering blue glaze, brimming with polished light after the early morning storms. Whatever I'd seen had subsided, gone back to its secret depths. I was turning to join the others again when I saw an unmistakable shudder close to shore, a rippled undertow of motion. And I was still holding my breath when the silver arch of a dolphin broke the surface and caught the sun on its flukes. I must have yelled out, because suddenly people were around me, my friends pointing joyfully towards the waves, and a few French tourists asking what all the excitement was about. Another dolphin leapt clear of the water. Then two of them, in perfect synchronicity, they climbed into the air, passing with graceful ease from one medium to the next, dragging sprays of water like silver harnesses from their tandem tails. They seemed suspended in an enduring moment, balanced on a high wire slung above the sea. Water droplets sloped from their sides like shards of light. About a dozen bottlenose dolphins made up the pod. They crested the surface of the sea with their beaks, playfully nudging the lid of their world and occasionally scribing arcs in the air. I later realized how time had dissolved while we watched the dolphins. Past and future and all the weight they carry had folded into one clear and measurable moment. Everything else had fallen away, brushed off like a scattering of crumbs. I was aware of feeling an ineffable joy and lightness of being. Eventually, the dolphins moved farther out to sea, where we watched them breaching in the distance like a range of receding hills. So that's just the opening section of an essay from my book called An Accumulation of Light. And the essay then goes on to explore this extraordinary day that did seem to be completely filled with light, mm-hmm. and what kind of meanings I'd taken from that.
Right. And that does exactly what you told me during AWP that you try to do, where you are inspired personally by writing that transports you into another place. And then mm-hmm. just mm-hmm. then it's like, I mean, I could see the dolphins and I could feel the cliff and the wind blowing up and the presence of the people and, you know, the light glinting. It's like, You know, some people describe in a way that it doesn't work, and you described in a way that really did. I was like, wow, he just transported me.
Thank you. Thank you very much. That's very, very kind of you.
That was really, really nice. Hearing an author read is different than reading their work themselves, yourself, you know. Hearing them read it is really, really cool.
Yes, and it's something that I love to, you know, I love to hear authors speak the work, read the work. So it's right. Really, really can be wonderfully engaging and an intimate moment, I think.
Well, and as you said, we could probably talk for 2 hours, but we don't have 2 hours.
No, sadly we don't. Sadly
no.
We don't.
So thank you so much for...
Thank you. Thank you very, very much, Marge. It's been a real, real pleasure.
For those interested in learning more, you can find Julian Hoffman's work at his website, www.julian, that's J-U-L-I-A-N, Hoffman with two Fs, .wordpress.com. You can find that information also on my tab at voiceofvashon.org/prose-poetry-and-purpose. Or take a gander, if you live in the Seattle area, over to Elliott Bay Book Company, where Julian visited, did a reading, and left some of his work for people to enjoy. I also highly recommend visiting terrain.org, which we did not get a chance to talk about a lot, but... Julian, you're on a board, correct?
Or Yes. Terrain.org is just a, if we can briefly very say, it's a wonderful, wonderful journal of the built and natural environments. We publish a whole host of essays, images, short stories and poetry about our relationship to the places around us and our engagement with the natural and the built environment and the soul of place, really.
Right, and it's not, I don't want people to think that it's just an online publication of writing. They are specifically focused on an intersection between people who are fascinated with architecture and the development of built environments like cities and towns, whatever, and bringing those people who are interested in that into contact with people who are writing about place, and how can we then have our architectural efforts improved because we're thinking beyond just the building and we're thinking about the living space. Is that a way to put it?
Yeah, perfectly said. Yeah.
Okay.
And it really is about the places around us, and whether that place be urban or rural. You know, you can easily find an article about urban farming, for example, as stories of other wilder landscapes, let's say. So it really is inclusive, and I think that's why it stands out a little bit from other environmental journals, because it's more inclusive of the kind of urban environments as well that the vast majority of people, of course, actually inhabit.
Right, and if someone is really interested in architecture or something, they would find this very, very much geared towards them. So, I mean, I love terrain.org. I'm planning to submit some of my work to them next year.
Yeah, do so. That would be wonderful.
Yeah, I'm excited. Okay, and now for my listeners, once again, thank you so much for listening to Prose, Poetry, and Purpose here on Voice of Vashon. My name is March Twisdale, program host and producer. If you have a favorite author who inspires you to believe in yourself and the future in particular, send me an email at marchpower@yahoo.com. I'd love to hear from you. Special appreciations to all of those who make Voice of Vashon the truly wondrous local radio station that it is. Do remember that your VOV will soon find a spot on your FM dial. You can learn more about our approved application, our fundraising, and our shows at www.voiceofvashon.org. We're going to raise the tower this year and have our own FM station. Yay, yay! Finally, I cannot thank my guest authors enough for the passion and commitment which sustains them as they spend years at their writing desk so that we can be transported across the planet or into a fantastical land all over a weekend. And now, here is our island's own Cami Lundeen and her fabulous title song, Run Free, one more example of inspiration through art.
Runs in the mountains like the sun sets beyond the sea, like the wind blows through the trees, on a crisp autumn evening while I've been free. It can't be caught, it can't be tamed, it cannot be held still. It can't be touched, it can't be felt, it can't be stolen away. Run free and be who you were made to be. Run wild and find the beauty that hides inside, that hides inside. Like the moon floats in the clouds above, like the bird soars in the endless sky, like the thunder that rolls out of sight on a stormy night, wild and free. It can't be caught, it can't be tamed, it cannot be held still. It can't be touched, it can't be felt. Start with your heart, let it be free.